Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Chico author Douglas Keister has written 6 novels and 2 memoirs and has just completed his 47th book, Ember. It's fiction, but readers of his previous books will recognize elements of Doug Keister's own expertise as author and photographer of cemeteries. The subject of a 2019 book was an event in his own backyard, the campfire that destroyed the city of Paradise. Today I'm going to ask Doug Keister about his latest book, Ember. It's a work of fiction, but the protagonist is a cemetery symbolism expert, not unlike the author himself. Douglas Keister, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
47 books?
Yes.
How have you done that?
Well, I keep wanting to be famous. You know, I always say Margaret Mitchell had one book, Gone with the Wind, and she was famous, and I'm still trying to be famous. My books are all mostly coffee table books on architecture and things like that, and I just kind of go from one to the next.
Well, I think your grade school teacher would be surprised, Doug, at what you have done, because on a previous book, you included a comment from your teacher.
I did.
Would you read that comment for us?
I will. This is on my book, Heartland, Growing Up in the Middle of Everything. And the teacher's comment was, "Douglas is capable of more than he is doing. He completes only a portion of the original work the first time, then he has to finish it later. He enjoys art activities and has created some very interesting things. Inattention has caused him some difficulty in reading."
This is Douglas Keister reading a comment from a teacher of his back when he was a little kid. And he now has written 47 books. And when you write these books, how do you... Because you didn't start out as a photographer,
right,
is my understanding.
Right.
So what was this process of writing? You've written a novel, more than one, but
yeah,
this recent book is a novel. And how do you do that?
Well, my first experience was when I was doing what's called coffee table book on Victorian houses on what are called painted ladies. And the writers of the book, it was a photo-driven book, but there was obviously a lot of writing, asked me to do something called notes on the photographs. And, you know, just to describe how I took the photographs, just a half a page little thing. And I submitted it, and the writer, who later became my agent, said that I had the gift. And I said, "Well, what?" He said, "Well, you can just write stories, and it just comes out of you." And I said, "Oh, okay." And I didn't really do much with that until some years later, when I was doing a book on cemetery. At first a children's book, but more longer version of writing was with a book called Going Out in Style, where the guy that was going to write it said, "Oh, I don't have time. Can you write it?" And I went, "Well, okay." And I just started writing it. And I wrote all these little stories about these mausoleums. And I'm not a writer with a capital W. I'm a storyteller. I have these wonderful people called editors that help me a lot. I don't know an adverb from an adjective or a preposition from a proposition. I really don't. And a gerund, what's a gerund? I don't know that stuff. But I can tell a story, and then I have people that help me out. Usually they're friends that think they can edit, and they're very good, but I kind of wear them out. The first time I did, I sent something to a friend. I hadn't seen it in a long, long time, but she said, "Oh, I love to, you know, correct typos and stuff." And she got back to me immediately and said, "Do you know about commas?" And I said, "No, I don't. I write like I speak. It just flows out. There are no commas when I speak."
Well, one experienced writer was saying, "Don't use too many commas." So you can get conflicting advice.
Yeah, that changes all the time. It's capitalization sometimes changes. And so I leave that to other people.
One thing that I enjoy about your book is For example, if you have a photograph of a monument in a cemetery, and then you give some information, it may only be a couple of paragraphs, but there's something in there, wow, that's interesting. So I find, I think you would be good at trivia.
Yeah, I am.
In fact, when I was reading this book, I have a friend who's good at trivia. His team always wins trivia contest. And so I said, do you know what a taphophile is? And he said, well, the end of that word is fear, because he was confusing it with a phobia.
Phobia, yeah.
And then when I said, he said, oh, no, no, no. So F-I-L-E, that means somebody who likes something. So if I call you a taphophile, I want the listeners to know I'm not insulting you.
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing. I don't think many people are familiar with this term.
As a matter of fact, most word processing programs are not familiar with it. I mean, autocorrect and things like that. Uh-huh. So you're not alone in that observation. But it is a real word. And it's a taphophile comes from, well, file, as like you said, a lover of something. Mm-hmm. And taphophile, the taph part is epitaph. And somebody that's interested in cemeteries and tombstones and epitaphs. So taphophile is a cemetery lover.
Like a bibliophile is a book lover.
Right, right.
Yeah. Guilty as charged.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you are too. So you create this book, and we see on the cover there's this beautiful – well, why don't you describe the cover for us?
Well, the cover is half of a face of a young woman and a cemetery in the background. And the woman on the cover, I used to have a studio, and every so often I would need somebody to model for me. And there was this young woman next door that worked at an accounting firm. And she was a pretty girl. There's no doubt about that. But she just lit up. So every so often I need a model, just to model something, to hold something, do something. And, you know, I paid her a little bit of money, and she modeled for me. But she just had that face that just lit up in front of a camera. There's certain people like that.
You mean this woman on this cover lives in Chico?
Yeah, yeah.
Because she's so beautiful and the picture is so lovely, I thought this was some stock photograph that you got from some company that does that. I'm all the more impressed.
Yeah, yeah. She lived in Chico, then she moved to New York, and now she's in Seattle. But I took it when she was going to Chico State. She was a little bit older when she was going, but she was getting her master's in accounting. And but she just had one of those faces.
And there's something she's wearing that we don't know when we start reading your book. What's that on her ear? And I'm not going to ask you to tell what it is because I like to leave some surprises for the readers.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see who the characters are in this story. Why don't you read a little bit for us? Maybe in the early part, part one, you have your book divided into parts. And what about this main character? I think I mentioned he is...
the main character is a guy named Jerry Jensen, and he is a professor, but he's a cemetery expert. He tried some other things when he was going to college, but he turned out he loved cemeteries, and so he became a cemetery expert, and so he's giving this lecture, and then there's a woman that shows up. That reminds me.
Yeah, he has an audience.
Yes, he has an audience, and but he sees this woman, and something clicks. It's a love at first sight thing that, you know, we always poo-poo, but it does happen.
In fact, I wondered about that, Doug, because I have the experience, so I know it's something that's true, but I think a lot of people, that doesn't exist.
Yeah,
there's no such thing as love at first sight. Do you get that? Do people question that premise?
Yeah, well, they want to question it, but then they go, well, you know. So, when you're writing fiction, obviously you stretch things a little bit, but not a lot. I mean, I don't think there's nothing in this book that I haven't experienced. So
that's why it's so real I speak for myself as a reader. That's why it's so real.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it there's nothing in here I haven't experienced. And so...
Well, when I'm reading this and he sees this young woman in the crowd, I'm thinking, oh, I know what she looks like. She looks like the cover of your book.
Right.
So in
right.
my imagination, I'm seeing this woman on the cover of your book when he's talking about
yeah,
her.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's hear about her.
Okay. The way he tells it, he knew from the moment he saw her, in the crush of a crowd at one of his lectures, she had been pushed into him, followed by her breathy, sorry, which she wasn't. His hand touched her shoulders to balance himself. He withdrew it and offered a welcome handshake. Jerry Jensen, and you are? She stumbled on her words. I know who you are. Jeremiah Quincy Jensen III. I'm here for your lecture on cemeteries, she smiled. Jerry is fine. And you? Oh, sorry. She looked at down at her hand, still holding his. Ember. Some people call me Emmy, but mostly it's Ember. Ember Owens. She finally let go of his hand. I'm so looking forward to this. Looking forward to this? She's thinking that. Why did I say that? So am I, he stumbled on his words. I'm looking forward to this, too. Then he's thinking, looking forward to this? Pleased to meet you, Emmy Ember, he nodded, turned away, then hesitated and looked back. Jerry! A man wedged himself through the crowd and pointed at his watch. 5 minutes. We need to mic you up and do a quick sound check. Sorry, Bob. He turned to excuse himself from the conversation with Ember. She was gone. A slight smile tracked across his face as he shook his head. Pretty girl. His smile grew larger, then quickly turned to a sigh when he remembered another pretty girl and recalled a favorite song, I'll Never Find Another You.
This is Chico, author and photographer, Douglas Keister. He's reading from his newest book, Ember, and we learn where the title comes from because we learn there's this young woman named Ember who comes to his lecture. And what is he lecturing on?
He's lecturing on cemeteries and specifically cemetery symbolism, which is, you know, what all of those things on cemetery, on tombstones mean. I mean, you don't have a lot of real estate available. So instead of a lot of writing on tombstones, you have symbols, like, you know, a dove or a secret society symbol, a broken bud, a broken column. So a lot of that, the beginnings of symbolism on tombstones was, you know, kind of, well, a long, long time ago, but the Catholics were more into it than other people. But it gradually became very dominant in all sorts of.
Well, one thing that your book piqued my interest in a lot of ways, but it made me want to go back because it's been years since I just kind of made a brief walk through the local, the large cemetery in Chico. And I thought, oh, I'd like to go back and see if I see some of these things you mentioned. For example, you mentioned the swastika, and I think now most people know that that was a very positive symbol until Hitler ruined it.
Hijacked it, yeah.
Yeah, hijacked it, yeah. But you also go into a little more detail about this emblem, and I found that interesting. Tell us more about the swastika.
Well, the swastika was a good luck sign and a power sign, but the one that kind of Hitler kind of took over was like a fire stick, and Charlemagne also used that. But it was very, very popular as a, you know, you see it on pharmacies for its good health. You go to India, you see lots of swastikas. Japanese culture, I've seen swastikas in Hawaii, you know, on tombstones. It's a little disconcerting at first, but then you realize that it's really a good luck symbol. And, you know, good luck sometimes, you know, goes with power, you know. But in a good way, you feel powerful, you feel validated. But Hitler took it.
I recall my alma mater, and I think it, maybe it was a gym, had a swastika on it. And I don't remember when this building was built, but I wish I had paid more attention now to when that. This was Indiana University, by the way, with a swastika
there. Yeah, it's very disconcerting when you see it, but then.
And you also say, and this is something I never thought about, you say the arms of the swastika resemble the sticks with handles that tribal members rubbed together to make fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Its various forms often represented the highest states of attainment in both the spiritual and worldly realms. And, of course, Hitler
ruined
it for us nowadays. Well, you remind me kind of some of your comments in here remind me of Sherlock Holmes, because you can take one little clue and it's amazing what you he got that just from that little clue.
I think people have said I write like a Spielberg movie. I keep things moving, you know.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of fat. So I drop clues, and they're very condensed clues. There's a lot in just one little sentence or something like that.
My guest is Chico author Douglas Keister. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author Douglas Keister, and we're talking about his newest book, Ember. Well, we have a brief introduction to this young woman named Ember, and why is she coming to his lecture? In fact, why don't you just read? This is a little later in your book. And this young woman is...
she got her degree, a bachelor's degree or something like that. And then she had kind of a regular life for a little while. And then she decided to go back and get her master's degree in anthropology.
And here's kind of a clue of what city they're in, because, and this, if you want to start reading there, where she says, I'm working on my anthropology PhD at Columbia.
Yeah. I'm working on my anthropology degree at Columbia. I got my master's years ago, but I wasn't happy with the job offerings. I saved up, and here I am, back at school. Then he says, PhD, that means dissertation. What's your subject? Cemeteries? He threw up his hands in the air. Feel free to use me, I submit. Well, not exactly. And then she thinks to herself, maybe I should have mentioned this sooner. Then he mocked disappointment. So what is it if it's not cemeteries? Something about lifestyles of tenured professors? That fits the umbrella of anthropology, but I'm not sure I'd be a very good subject. She reached over and touched his arm to reassure him, holding her hand just a heartbeat too long. No, it's not about doddering academics. What then? His piercing blue eyes caught her, triggering a comfortable, uncomfortable feeling. Allow me to explain. She took a deep breath. My dissertation topic is about people grouping together while still preserving personal identity. Is the grouping driven by herd mentality, protection, or fear of the other? Like many things, it's a combination of factors. But what is the driving force? And what happens when someone is driven from the herd? What happens to their identity when they don't identify with a group? He interrupted her. Definitely sounds like a Margaret Mead-worthy dissertation topic. A long and slightly confused dissertation topic is half the battle, Ember laughed. But why cemeteries? Jerry leaned back and crossed his arms. And how can I help? Ember drummed her fingers on the table. The identification with the group is so strong that people use a very finite amount of space on a gravestone to memorialize themselves as a member of a large group, rather than using the space to list their individual accomplishments. He cocked his head. Interesting. And she interrupted. I'd like to explore if that group versus individual identification has changed over time. Did people identify with a group a century ago more than they do now? An individual identity more, is an individual identity more common now? What's memorialized on a headstone can tell a story. She smiled and reached over with a quick touch on his forearm. And who better than a cemetery symbolism expert to help?
And this is a cemetery symbolism expert reading from his latest book. The title is Ember. And this is Douglas Keister. He is a Chico author and photographer. This book doesn't have any photographs in it. But I, when you mentioned somebody who was in a cemetery in Paris, I got your book off the shelf, but the cemetery in Paris, and so, because you have beautiful color photographs in that. And of course, you do have a beautiful color photograph on the cover. So this idea for a dissertation sounds so real. I thought, Doug, do you know somebody who really was going to write a dissertation on this subject?
Well, no, but I've known people that have written dissertations on things that are kind of really obscure. And I mean, that's kind of the point of doing a dissertation often is to contribute to the collective knowledge about things. So, you know, dissertation are often very, very kind of very finite little nuances of culture. So I don't know anybody that's done this. I'm not a PhD candidate myself on this, so.
But I'm thinking maybe somebody in anthropology will read your book and say, that's a good idea. I think I'll write a dissertation.
They should. Yeah. But I have known people doing that, and it's so funny, the subjects they pick, and you go, what? What? Yeah. Well, that's why they're really writing it, because they're trying to inform the general public.
But this makes sense, too, because you make the point in your book that there's not a lot of room on a gravestone, and often they will identify with a group rather than tell what they did right. as a human being in their life. And one of the cemeteries that I visited, I noticed how many mentioned their military, what their rank was in the military.
Yeah, actually, my father just has a very simple tombstone, and it's got sergeant, you know, in World War II. That's it. You know, birthday, nothing about me, nothing about his children, nothing about, you know, where he worked or what, or he was, you know,
Because he had a full life as a human being.
Yeah.
But that limited space, that's what he chose to. And not just your dad, so many people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that experience for them was really kind of life defining.
Yeah.
And a lot of the tombstones that we see, if you go to the Chico Cemetery, we'll have secret society emblems on them, the Masons, the Oddfellows, there are tons of them, because it was a real big part of their life.
In fact, because I read a book of yours, I went to the cemetery in Pasquinta, and there are a lot of military ranks. Now, I might mention, too, in passing, that the ancestors of somebody quite famous, Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks' father is there, and a lot of other ones, too. Yeah.
And I learned that in your book and went to visit there. So I enjoyed when I would be reading your book, the preparation, well, I've got to go to Pasquinta and see that cemetery. Now, my favorite, though, you're writing about a cemetery in Paris. I've got to go to Paris and go to this cemetery. And so I really enjoyed all the things you said about the, I'll mention the name of the cemetery, Père Lachaise. And I took your book, and you have a map, a guidebook, right. And people would stop me and ask me, well, where's so-and-so buried? And one woman, I think she may be asking about Chopin, but I heard Champollion because I'm quite a fan of the guy who deciphered the Rosetta Stone. I've been to his museum in the town in France where he was born, in Figeac, and I love that museum. And so I thought she was asking about this favorite of mine who happens to be buried there. But there's so many people that are buried in this cemetery that you'd want to spend a lot of time.
Of course, the first thing everybody wants to see is Jim Morrison. And then Oscar Wilde and, you know, and Marcel.
In fact,
Marcel.
They had to put barriers up for those two you just mentioned.
One of the characters I think you're getting at is, to back up just a tiny bit, like I said a little earlier, everything I said in the book is something I know about or experienced. And without divulging anything to, the main character, Ember, has had some tortured relationships, shall we say. And a friend of, you know, we all know people like that, where they just can't seem to find the right person. And that's just a way of life. But there was one person in particular, and she's just had so many problems finding the right guy for lots of reasons. But at one point, I was talking to her, and this was before I was doing this novel, and I said, have you ever heard of Rachel? And she said, no. And then I said, well, she was an actress in the early to mid-19th century in France, very, very extremely famous. And I asked her, have you heard about her? And she said, no. And so I said, there's a very, very famous quote by Rachel. And Rachel was unabashed. She loved men, but that's plural. And so when some lover of hers, and she had many, many, many very famous lovers, when some lover of hers said, take me. I want to be your special. I want to be your special one. And she said, I prefer renters than owners.
Yeah.
And so my friend went, yeah.
Well, like I mentioned, your novel does not have color photographs in it. So I took down off my shelf your book, Stories in Stone, Paris, A Field Guide to Paris Cemeteries and Their Residents, because I did not remember Rachel. And I don't think I went to her grave because there's so many. And I didn't remember what you wrote about her or the photograph. So I got the book down off the shelf and saw when she was born. And what do you think listeners might like to know about this woman called Rachel?
Yeah, yeah. And she was, like I said, very, very famous. She was a Jewish actress.
She's an actress.
Yeah, yeah. Actress. And
and you might tell when you give her birth date. She was born in 1821, died in 1858.
Yes, probably tuberculosis, probably. Mm-hmm. And she just traveled the world. She had multiple lovers, and she just didn't want to settle down with any in particular. And she seemed happy with that. But she did have a couple children. So she just had a very full, rich life, and her funeral was just packed with all of these people. It was like a celebrity funeral.
Because she was a celebrity.
Yes, she was.
And
yeah.
I was surprised when you said that she was the most noted French actress in the first half of the 19th century and one of the most famous French actresses of all time.
Yeah.
I was shocked at that.
Yeah. And her... her most famous character was from Greek mythology, actually from the book from Jean Racine, you can pronounce it better than I can, called Phaedra. And Phaedra into my novel, and I can't disclose all that.
You don't want to tell us right now who Phaedra is, but that name comes up.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of in passing at first, and then, we heard that name earlier in the book.
And older people such as us may remember Nancy Sinatra's song called Some Velvet Morning.
Do you know, you've heard of earworms? When I was reading your book, that song kept running through my head, and I thought, I've got to get this song out of my head. But every time I'd come across that name, that song would run through my head.
Yeah.
So, well, let's see what happens in your book and how your characters decide to go to Paris.
Oh, yeah. So they're
because this Ember says, I haven't traveled much.
Yeah, yeah. And so, they meet and they meet every now and then. It's love at first sight, but they both have their own issues.
Well, and she also, I like this quote because I think a lot of, say, husbands will identify with this. He said, I'm not very good at being told what to do.
Yeah.
I think both genders could don't like to be told what to do.
Yeah, so I got a lot of little zingers in here.
Yes, you
do. People identify with. So they're having all of these coffee shop conversations. They meet for coffee, and you know they talk about cemeteries and things like that, and just their lives. And so she at one point says, "You know, I haven't traveled much. I've been to Europe."
I've never been to Europe.
Amber looked up, her eyes lingering on a cluster of clouds, then turned back to meet his eyes. "Where would you suggest? Somewhere with history and culture, and of course, a good cemetery." Then he says, "Somewhere you feel comfortable exploring new sites and maybe feel a little bit at home." He didn't wait for an answer. "Paris, definitely Paris." "Paris? Without a doubt. Why?" He sat back in his chair and affectionately studied Ember, the way she looked, how she dressed, her body language. A familiar jolt ran through him. Again, he dismissed it. A pretty girl and a single man. Of course he felt that way. Then he says, "Paris has an informal formality." She cocked her head, asking for more. "You'd fit in perfectly." He held up a finger, playfully waving it at her. "I could see you strolling down the Champs-Élysées in a sundress, having an espresso at a sidewalk cafe, ducking into the Louvre, then going back to your hotel where you change into one of those little black dresses and attend the opera." He let his mind wander, thinking how glorious it would be to be at her side. Then she thinks, "Take me," she wanted to say, but instead inquired, "And I think they have a pretty cool cemetery, yes?" She looked down, trying to remember the name. "I know. I think Jim Morrison is buried there." He nodded knowingly. "Everybody goes there to see Jim." He shook his head. "But there's so much more to see." "So much more? Where?" "Sorry, Père Lachaise. There's so much more in Père Lachaise than Jim Morrison." "Such as?" He smiled. "How much time you got?" She put her elbows on the table and rested her chin on her hands. Jerry spent the next 15 minutes reciting the history of Père Lachaise, established in 1804 as the first garden cemetery in the world, and rattling off a list of famous residents other than Jim Morrison, including Oscar Wilde, Chopin, Marcel Marceau, Sarah Bernhardt, Modigliani, Edith Piaf, Marcel Proust, Colette, and France's real-life Romeo and Juliet, Heloise, and Abelard. "You've convinced me," she said as she took her arms off the table and sat back in her chair.
After a break, I'll be continuing our conversation with Douglas Keister. His newest book is entitled Ember. It's fiction, but there's a lot of truth in it. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author Douglas Keister. His latest book is a work of fiction. It's a mystery and romance. The title is Ember. And even though it's fiction, I think there's so much in your book that people could say, "Oh, I know, I've experienced that." And little tidbits of trivia, if I want to call it that. Oh, I didn't know that. For example, I have a friend who has a Subaru, and she and I go for walks, and this morning I said, "Linda, do you know what the word Subaru means?" in Japanese? She didn't have a clue. So tell us about that symbol that we see. And the Subaru is right up there. Consumer Reports gives Subarus this top rating. But I don't think people know.
Well, if you look at a Subaru, the emblem on it has all these little stars. One of them, well, they're different sizes. But Subaru is the Japanese name for Pleiades, which is the Seven Sisters. And so that works into the whole story. So I throw all that stuff in there.
Well, you in your book, you tell us too that when you tell us things, I think, gosh, is that really true? And so I do a lot of Googling, Doug, when I'm reading your book. And so, for example, I wanted to know more about what Google might say about the Subaru. And so I did, and it said, at first it said it means unite, but then it said that the Subaru was the Japanese word, it was named for the Pleiades, as you just were saying, and these stars are for this constellation, the Pleiades. I thought, gosh, I would have never, and my friend was delighted.
So you didn't believe me.
Well, no, I did, but I wanted to be sure that I wasn't misleading my friend when I told her Subaru. She says, oh, I'm going to tell a friend of mine that. So she was excited to learn that. Now, what you mentioned about the Subaru and the stars and why the Subaru has its stars on there, you also get into the topic of secret societies. And I hadn't thought of it. You don't hear much about them anymore. And so this also, while I was talking to my friend, was telling her about why you don't, well, you think, well, if they're secret, then you don't hear about them because they're secret. But what purpose did they serve, I guess, is the question I want you to give you a chance to explain.
Well, back before, back when they started, especially in a small town like Chico, people needed places to gather. And so they became kind of like a club. And the oldest of the secret societies usually is thought of as the Masons. And as a matter of fact, George Washington was a Mason, Ben Franklin was a Mason, Paul Revere was a Mason. And they often say that the Continental Congress that wrote the Constitution was a Masonic convention. So many Masons were there. A lot of the principles came from that. But it was a social gathering place. People weren't as mobile then as they are now. So it was like church. It was that sort of thing, but with more drinking involved.
Yeah, but also we didn't have health insurance.
Right,
like we
right.
Did then.
A lot of the secret societies provided like a doctor and health care and death care, provided a tombstone. And so in the 1930s, and well, the 20s and the 30s, when we started seeing insurance companies and Social Security and things like that, a lot of the smaller secret societies kind of died out. But the larger ones, you know, like the Masons, are still around.
And visible. They're not secret.
Right,
well,
yeah.
We don't know exactly,
some,
but
some
they're
of the
parades.
Things are.
And, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oddfellows and Masons often have their own plots, sometimes even their own cemeteries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you go, a lot of places, I think New Orleans is one of the best places to see that sort of thing. We got the Masonic Cemetery, the Oddfellows Cemetery. But it started as a drinking club.
That's what I read in your book. I thought, that was not my dad.
Yeah, it was actors, people in the theater industry. And you couldn't drink on Sundays in New York, like a lot of places, blue laws. So if you have a club, well, you can do whatever you want. So they formed this club, and after a while they thought, well, Jolly Corks, maybe we should change it to something a little more palatable. So that's how the Elks became the Elks.
Now, there's another something that I hadn't thought about. You mentioned, say, the Arm & Hammer was a tradesman organization, and then you have your character say, unfortunately, no. The Arm & Hammer is more deception.
Yeah.
And how could a symbol like Arm & Hammer be deceptive?
Yeah, well, there was this, this is just kind of like the swastika sort of thing. There was this organization that took, a lot of people know the compass and the square is a Masonic sign.
Yes,
I think most
that's
people
familiar.
Probably have seen that. And so this organization that was a white supremacist organization took that compass and square and put an arm and a hammer in the middle of it, you know, kind of a power
white
type
supremacist
symbol.
Organization.
Yeah, yeah. So because they were disguising themselves, they were hijacking the Masonic symbol.
Thus, and they were a secret organization.
Yeah, yeah. And they tried to make themselves look like this benevolent. They weren't. And then the female side of it, because most of these organizations had a female.
They're a women's group. Yeah,
yeah. And it was called the Daughters of America. And they basically are trying to disguise themselves like the, you know, Daughters of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. But no.
They weren't the D-A-R. They were the D-A.
And if you ever saw the movie The Help, that was the organization that these white women belonged to, the D-A, not the D-A-R.
And I totally missed that. I saw that movie some years ago, the movie The Help, but I totally missed that.
Yeah.
Now, you also say that what they were is called a nativist organization.
Right.
So if they were a nativist organization, that means they were anti-immigrant.
Yeah, anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, usually, but yeah, mostly anti-immigrant, white supremacist.
Jerry says, you have Jerry say in the book, nowadays we'd probably lump them together with white supremacist organizations.
Yeah, yeah. And they usually put things like, you know, the flag and the Bible on their symbols. That, once again, they've hijacked those symbols and used them for their own purposes.
Yeah. So you mentioned other nativist organizations and cemeteries like the Order of Red Men.
Yeah. That one is actually sort of comical in the sense that it was called the Order of Red Men. Their purpose was to adopt the ideas of Native Americans, respect for the land and nature and things like that, but they excluded Native Americans.
That's what I'm reading this sentence and said, so they're called the Order of Red Men that ascribe to Native American values, but excluded Native Americans.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, so.
And then you have your character, Jerry, say, fortunately, a lot has changed in the last 100 years, which isn't to say that more change isn't needed. So we have these different organizations, and you help us understand the symbols that we might see in a cemetery from some time ago that would We don't learn this in our history classes, for example.
Right. You know, another thing, if I could mention, we mentioned Ember and her character. It's kind of a little bit of a role reversal, you might say, in the book, because Ember is the one that kind of goes through a lot of men. As you know, it's kind of a stereotype that men, you know,
is with renters, not owners.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Yes. Just like Rachel.
Yes.
But Jerry has been mourning the death of his wife, who was murdered. We can't get too much into that because we're going to.
Well, you know, I do want to mention that he is mourning this wife that died 20 years ago.
Right.
And I have friends when I lost my spouse that. Well, get over it. They didn't say it that way.
Right,
but
right.
You could tell they're saying, well, he's been dead for 2 months now.
Yeah, yeah.
And here's a guy whose wife has been dead 20 years. So I'm thinking, I hope people read this book.
Yeah.
And know that you don't just get over it.
You don't just get over it, yeah. And let's explain in the book, the tip of the iceberg is that, you know, it was like the perfect, everything was perfect. And this was it. He was one of the lucky ones that found the perfect woman, and then something happens to her. So, and that's from experience too, not my personal experience, but some people I know that have had that experience of either being on one side or the other of that equation, somebody that's maybe dating somebody who's lost their spouse. And there's a line, which is unfortunately very apt. It's that if you're on the other side of that equation, you're dating somebody who's lost their longtime lover, spouse, whatever. He said you can't compete with a ghost because you know it's not that the marriage ended with badly or with a divorce or something like that.
Yeah.
And so how are you gonna? And so this my character Jerry is holding on to this, and he's holding on to it very, very deeply. Mm-hmm. because it's all explained.
I sometimes get asked why I'm still wearing a wedding ring, and I say, well, my husband died, but we never divorced.
Right, yeah.
I'm still married to this person.
Yeah, and he has the same thing, and, you know, at one point, Ember mm-hmm. sees that there's a dent in his finger where he's taken off the ring, but it's recent. So she's first thinking, oh, this guy's married, you mm-hmm. know, and he's meeting mm-hmm. me, and he's mm-hmm. taking the ring off. But no. He left it on for, like, 19 years, yeah. and finally a friend convinced him to take it off.
Well, there is a lot of mystery. This is a romance, but it's also a mystery story because there's this mystery man that he keeps appearing, and there'll only be just a few sentences about him, but I wonder, who is this guy?
Yeah.
That he appears, and he appears under mysterious circumstances. So we don't want to tell people. We don't want to spoil that, who this mystery man is. And you start to say, the title of this book, Ember,
yes, it does have to do with the fire.
So I was thinking, okay, that has to do with fire, and I'm holding back because I don't want to spoil the mystery that is evolving, and that Jerry is trying to solve.
Right, right.
And a lot of times we're in suspense. How is he going to solve this?
Yeah.
So I think people will enjoy this book on a lot of levels, Doug.
Thank you.
So thank you for writing this book.
Yeah. Well, my old agent said all novels have a beginning, a muddle, and an end.
And so now we've gotten out of the muddle.
Yeah.
We've unmuddled.
The muddle in the middle, yeah.
Well, again, I'm not going to spoil all the surprises, the mystery, and how the characters solve it. The title of the book, it's fiction, but there's so much reality in it. Title is Ember, and the author is Chico author Douglas Keister. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
The bookstore lovers. I looked around and see thousands of books written by builders, actors, and cooks. People seem busy with their studious looks. Historical books about all types of sports, why so many heroes end up in our courts, how cruise ships can take you to various ports. I do need a book to learn about plants and learn about termites eaten by ants. There's Baryshnikov's book, The Beauty of Dance. Fishing techniques inside of these books, the tying of flies, and safe barbless hooks, a safe move in chess using king and your rooks, guidebooks and maps and ways to arrive, down dusty roads with directions to drive, the Olympic game winners and their somersault dives. Styling books, too, sit untouched by most. They'd rather be reading an influencer's boast and how you can become a splendiferous host. A section on science and info on bats, how they survive on small flies and gnats, guinea pig raising, and puppies and cats. Books about war we continue to add, care for your family, your mother and dad. Cherish those memories when you were a lad. Ideas are offered about some race in France, and a book about Serbia and a tiny village named Spance, and Any Means Necessary, written by Lance. A large section, too, with reduction in price. Learn how to whistle, make meals with burnt rice, and how to make water by melting the ice. Finally, a spot I can sit down and read about Hoover Dam's building and the resulting Lake Mead, teaching children the difference between wanting and need. Basketball, tennis, books on fair play, why June 21st is our longest day, how to get drudgery out of your way, how to save money and not waste your pay. A quick little summary right there on back covers, right there for us all, the great bookstore lovers. Mark Malinger.
Pale sign on cemetery's back fence calls, now hiring. No details like the wage, benefits, duties, just two words that make me hide behind a laugh. Would my boss demand total discipline, no motion, nothing that would disturb ants, beetles, fungi, grass, daisies, worms? employees whose work is to be dead lie on your backs. Let time leave you alone. You'll need talent for this lack of heart and thought, then no feeling in your lips, skin, even your groin. I'm so glad I don't need this work. I couldn't record birds and their songs without my hearing and sight. I'd be useless monitoring weather if my mind were so gone. Gardening could be tough with numb, still hands. Could I be a travel writer sending dispatches from the next world? Intriguing, but so far no one's work has arrived, presenting the afterlife in an email. I'll find earthbound adventures to describe, so bye-bye sound. You'll find folks with no choice. They'll flock to you. For now, I'll run away. Paul Beltz.
A bird just hit the window. The world forgets broken things. It's too late to truly learn again, to fly. The air must love you back, must want you, with the same heart it wants the rain showers and sunbeams. To hold the morning fog as a lost child found. Wind must love the feather, to dance the ether, and seduce the velvet song to sing wild and free. How words want to be calm and are betrayed by an urgent tone of panic and the deep knowing, the instinct that your sky has left you, liftless and lost in the song, now but a cry. Come back. Don't leave me. Please don't leave me. Invisible vapor across the eye that now clatters away through the autumn leaves. Soft down now still. Out of place on the patio stones, the broken wing trying to catch the spell again, panicked in the spent magic of a drowning heart. Lovers are content to leave. Gravity is the heartbreak to hollow bones. Mike Waltz.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.